This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg County gets hacked. The county's files are held for a ransom. The county decides not to pay. Duke Energy is also kind of hacked, with customer exposure possibly dating back as far as 2008. Charlotte gets a new mayor and a newer, younger city council. Johnson C. Smith University is put on probation, and North Carolina senators help pass the new GOP tax plan. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Nursing something. We don't know what, but we're all staying away from him.
I'm a little sick, it's right. True, but that's it. You make it sound like I've got something special in my coffee.
Say what else is here? Kirsten Garris is government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Doss Helms is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric Spanberg is here, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Nice to see you as well.
Thank you, Mike.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get us to Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup, and you can watch us on Facebook Live. Yesterday's New York Times reported on Mecklenburg County's computers being hacked, its files held for ransom, by saying, quote, "In a world rocked by hackers, trolls, and online evildoers, finally someone has said enough is enough." And that someone is the government of Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. Earlier this week, a county employee evidently opened an email, and suddenly the county's files were locked by ransomware, and the hackers asked for the tidy sum of two bitcoins, which amounted on Monday to about $23,000. It's probably more than that today because it keeps going up. But County Manager Dina DiIorio said no.
We believe that by not paying the ransom and rebuilding the systems by ourselves, it will take us some number of more days, but we don't think it's significantly more than it would be if we had bought the ransomware.
Now, there's a report in the paper this morning that as they tried to rebuild these files from their backups, ransomware began to creep its ugly head back into the system. How did that happen? Is it just still there?
I mean, I think they're sending more emails because their response was to disable the ability to open attachments in some emails and urge their employees to, whenever possible, do their communication in person or on the phone rather than through emails.
She was on the program yesterday, and she said that yesterday before this happened.
Well, I think part of it, Mike, is probably right down to the New York Times article that you just referenced. I mean, let's face it, if for ransomware to work, people have to be willing to pay the ransom. If people stop paying the ransom, then these criminal organizations lose their access to all those lovely bitcoins.
But what I'm asking is, were there remnants of this in the backups, or did they actually try to do this?
It sounds like there's more attacks,
and
that's the point that I was getting to. When you have a publication as widespread as the New York Times giving us Mecklenburg County a pat on the back, they may have inadvertently left with that pat on the back a little kick me or hit me sign, and you know that's the thing. I wouldn't be surprised. I wasn't surprised, to hear that Mecklenburg County is starting to see more attacks.
Well, and these groups are phishing all the time, all over the place. As was said, I think several times this week, it's highly unlikely that they set out to find Mecklenburg County. They're hitting everyone, and if they get a 1% return rate, then you know they're making plenty of money.
I'm sure by now everybody knows how this happened. But Dina DiIorio joined us at the top of the program yesterday to talk about all of this and told us how this happened.
You know, people say don't open emails from people you don't know. Well, in this case, they open an email from somebody who they thought they did know. So it's very difficult for employees to be able to make a distinction, and that's why we really need to understand how it got into the first place.
This is one of those instances when I've gotten these emails, and I'm sure everybody at this table has gotten these emails, where you get an email from somebody you know, but it's not from them. Their email address has been spoofed. Is that how this happened, essentially?
Apparently, yeah. They thought it was an email from a colleague saying, open this attachment. And again, I bet everybody town identified with that person who hit the click. And apparently it flagged right up, right? It said, you've been hacked and put the ransom demand. I mean, boy, that's got to be a sick feeling. And most of us think we're pretty savvy about it. But you're right. I've gotten one this spring that was from somebody with whom I was actively corresponding about a story. And thank goodness I was out of the office so that when I got back in, there were warnings saying don't open because I might have fallen for that.
Well, and
one.
The other thing I think that's scary, at least to me, is that, you know, we all read so many emails every day, whatever you do, that you kind of get just lulled into this numbness of click, of a sudden you hit the wrong one. And
but aren't there safeguards? Can you safeguard against that? Are there antivirus, anti-malware, whatever you want to call them, pieces of software that protect you? So are we deficient in that department at the county level?
Well, here's a better way to look at it. I mean, we were just, since you've been mentioning that I wasn't feeling well, this seems an appropriate example.
You need some anti-malware is what you need.
Well, think about antivirus, vaccines for human beings. Right. We guess, we try to play catch-up, but nature evolves. Well, so do criminal gangs, and so do the viruses that infect computers. A lot of the times, you find the antivirus software trying to play catch-up. It's difficult to predict where criminals are going to go, where the hackers are going to go. So you're playing inherently catch-up. So the simple, non-sexy, easiest way to kind of deal with these situations is not necessarily just to try to prevent them, but to build backups.
Just
to make sure those backups are actually working.
And the reason the county was quote-unquote crippled, their computers were crippled, is because in an attempt to stop this thing from spreading throughout all of the systems in the county, and only attacked, I think, 30 or 40 computers.
48 of the 500.
They shut all of the computers down.
Once we realized that we had a ransomware situation, the firm that we were working with told us that you need to shut everything down so it doesn't spread. So part of the reason some of our systems are down is because we actually took them down on purpose so that we could make sure that they didn't get infected.
And she told us yesterday that they're confident that no personal information, no health records, no social security numbers, no credit card numbers, et cetera, had been released into the wild, and they believe the attack came from either Ukraine or Iran. How can they be confident, or do we know how they can be confident in any of those things?
Well, a lot of security experts, at least we've talked to this week, have said hackers really don't want your information. They just want to hold on to it, freeze it, so that you pay the ransom and you get it back. They really could care less what your information is. They're just crippling you so you can't do anything, right, and they're trying to force you to pay. And that's why we talked with Chris Swecker. He's a former FBI director, and he said, you know, these ransoms are pretty low, quote-unquote, you know, $23,000, because they want you to pay. Versus if it was like $2 billion or something crazy, it's like, well, okay, we're not paying that. So you said there's a reason why the ransom is 2 Bitcoin or much lower than that. And actually, a lot of government agencies have paid because it is easier and cheaper to pay. And even Dino DiOrio said that Tuesday that was an option because it is faster.
And even though $23,000 isn't a lot of money to an organization the size of Mecklenburg County, if you get enough people paying you $23,000 and you're a hacker sitting in a bedroom someplace, you're making a big cash payout over time.
Absolutely. But here's the trick. There is no guarantee that even if you pay, you're going to get your files can be restored. I mean, David Borax, a reporter with WFAE, spoke with an author yesterday about all this. And he said, you know, there was back in almost, I hate to use this phrase, but I'll use it anyway, the golden era of hackers where you could trust that if they got in, if you got hit with ransomware and you paid up, that they would send you an effective, you know, key to get your files back. Right. Those days seem to be gone. So just because you pay up doesn't mean you get a darn thing back.
So they're shooting themselves in the foot, because if Mecklenburg County has said no and they realize that they could rebuild their files from their backups in just about the same amount of time and with the same amount of effort that it would have taken to use this key that they were going to pay $23,000 for with no guarantee that it would actually work, won't that set an example going forward to these hackers and these ransomware developers to say,
But this has been going on. This is not a new thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just sort of, you know, it's like on the subway. the guy played, you know, you just need one person or 10 people to sign up. Again, if you get 1% who are going to pay that ransom, that's plenty for them. So, yeah, plenty of people will say no, or we don't trust you or whatever, but you get some that will, and that's usually enough.
But you also have the situation which I was talking about, which is that may mean, and again, I'm not surprised that Mecklenburg County has seen more attempts at hacking, that just as the New York Times held Mecklenburg County up as an example, right, the hackers may want to do the same and really come at them to say, hey, trust me, you better pay up, because otherwise, you know, we're coming after you.
And because the New York Times pointed this out, it seems like this must be a rare move. Here's what Dan Lohrman, I think that David Borax talked to him. He's former chief security officer for Michigan state government. Here's what he had to say about that.
Quite frankly, it's like 2/3 of the people pay. And, you know, in other parts of the world, maybe less than 50%, but I think that's one of the reasons why the U.S. gets maybe hit more than other parts of the world. But, yeah, Oftentimes, it's the path of least resistance.
So is this a bold move on the part of Mecklenburg County? Have we done a bold, daring thing by saying no?
You need Mecklenburg County on that wall.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it. I know Mecklenburg, I mean,
Winter
millennial talking
coming.
In the room. Mecklenburg County posted a little, like, Batman, you know, like, icon saying, yep, here we are, we're the heroes. So, I mean, I guess they did. And, I mean, honestly, Dina Diorio also explained how, you know, this is, they have enough backups, it's secure enough, it's, you know, this is a chance they can try and rebuild slowly.
So, Kirsten, as the government reporter, how is this impacting citizens right now?
Everything is, as Dina Diorio said, everything's working, but very slowly. And everyone's has gone from electronic processing to manual. So very, very slow. I know, like, at the jailhouse, intake and the releasing folks has been much slower because they're doing this all by paper.
Right.
DSS, they're working, but if you need that, their medical scheduling for their buses, that people that distribute their medication, that is down, so you have to call. So the message is call ahead of time because you don't know what's working and what isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything, tax payments, marriage applications, if you're trying to apply for a county job, all of those things, you may hit a brick wall, you know, because it would normally be done digitally, and you either have to figure out a backdoor way to do it with the old-fashioned paper, or maybe you have to wait a few days.
So if you're applying for a job to be an IT person.
Ransomware, yeah.
Yeah.
You get right to the front
ransomware.
Line. Yeah.
Just hack your way through.
And we have to take a break, but the Register of Deeds is affected by this, too. Does that impact sales of homes right now?
Code enforcement has been slow because people can't get their houses inspected. So, and they're having to call the inspector directly to get stuff done.
About 370,000 Duke Energy customers may have been hacked as well through no fault of Duke Energy, but we'll talk about that when we come back on Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup, our weekly edition with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. You'll find that on Spectrum Cable. Just always makes me wonder if people know where Spectrum is.
Channel 14, always.
Yes, we know that. Okay, let's talk about another hack. Duke Energy announced a data breach this week involving about 370,000 customers in the Carolinas, including Charlotte, that may have had addresses, banking, and other personal data stretching back to 2008 involved. This was not their problem.
Correct.
This was a third-party vendor problem. But how did they discover this?
Well, the vendor that was hacked was called TIO Networks, and they basically, if you wanted to walk up to pay your power bill, you know, at the random locations where you can do that, they're the people who actually process the payment and give it over to Duke. And apparently this dates back, as you said, you know, quite a while ago, back to 2008. They found out about it, Duke Energy found out about it, when TIO basically announced the hack. And this is an ongoing problem that you hear a lot about.
So this only involves people who walked up and didn't send their payment through the mail or do it electronically.
Right.
They went and to pay
it personally. Dated to 2008?
2008.
Yep.
Yeah, so you're talking 9 years. And it's not clear exactly how long this, at least not clear to me, how long this hack was in place, right? Because just because it was first detected in 2008, it may still have had some kind of a knock-on effect.
And it wasn't just Duke Energy. 370,000 Duke Energy employees, customers were affected by this, potentially. But 1.6 million people who deal with this company, this third-party vendor, which is now owned by PayPal,
correct,
had their material possibly exposed.
Yeah, and this is actually the kind of the inverse of what Kirsten was describing when it comes to ransomware attacks. This is an attack where they actually want that information because it is the key stuff. It is Social Security numbers, bank accounts, addresses, all kinds of valuable information that then can be bundled up and sold on the dark web. So that's the question here.
So what are they doing about this? Anything?
Well, Duke, frankly, is letting TIO handle it, which is an interesting thing because if I personally, and I'm actually not a Duke Energy customer, but if I were and I got a letter in the mail.
Do you use candles?
No, I don't. I live in the realm of Huntersville where actually we're with Energy
United. He's living
United,
off the grid, literally.
But, basically what they said is this wasn't our hack. This isn't our issue. We're going to let the third-party vendor send all the mail notifying people. But I would argue it's fair to say that most people have never heard of this company. So if they see something from TIO, they're going to say, well, that's junk mail and not necessarily read it. That is a potential problem here.
Yeah.
And these hacks and breaches start to feel like termites. You know, any one might be small, but so much of, whether you're an individual or a business, so much of our lives and our finances are digital now. And you just wonder, and I mean,
right,
it almost seems amazing if you have not
yeah.
been you know, had your identity cloned as a fraud. But you just think there are so many ways that confidential information is getting out, that bad stuff is getting in.
And look at the big companies that have been hacked. Equifax,
yep.
My God.
Right.
They know everything about everybody. Yep. Yahoo, Target, and Uber. Is any government entity looking into this, either in terms of what the government can do to strengthen cybersecurity or in terms of regulations to be imposed on companies who then have to protect that information
well,
in some way?
The short answer is the obvious one, yes, but where is it going to go? In fact, one of the more interesting things now is a lot of these hacks, we're not finding out about them until years and years, and in this case, 9 years later. So there is a move on Capitol Hill to try to get to force companies to be more timely in announcing that they have been hacked.
Well, your analogy about medical viruses is absolutely right. I mean, these things are constantly mutating,
yep.
So you're always playing catch-up. So, I this is not going away. This is not a fad or a one-time thing. This is going to be with us, you know.
And to complicate it, when there's news about a breach then, and you get an email saying, let us help you figure out whether you've been a victim,
mm-hmm.
You have to be really careful about
right.
that solicitation. Or if you do a search and you get, you know, you could be getting into another.
It's another phishing scam.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is the kind of thing that makes everybody want to be a Luddite. So,
and you were just knocking me for supposedly being off the grid.
So, welcome, my friend.
I mean, how do you you can't protect yourself. You can't foresee these things. I mean, you really
you,
can't protect yourself.
You just
yourself.
Try and use common sense.
Well, and vigilance. I mean,
and
let's
vigilance,
face it.
Well, yeah.
Common sense would be the safe, to me, in my head, the safest way to pay my electric bill would not be to pay it the way I pay it, electronically.
Yeah.
Would not be to put it in the mail.
Fair point.
Right.
Would be to walk it to this place and hand them the check.
That oh, yeah. No. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying.
You're right.
You have to sort of just know that you're vulnerable and you do the best you can. I mean, what choice do you have? No one, very few people can live without smartphone and online banking and online bill paying and all those things. So, I mean,
if you take out all your cash and stuff it under your mattress, you know, the old-fashioned criminal may come into your
right.
house and steal it.
Well, they haven't got time for that. They're too busy hacking.
That's why I use Bitcoin
exactly.
only.
All right. Meanwhile, Duke Energy is seeking a rate increase not only to pay for coal ash cleanup, but to continue their transition to natural gas instead of coal. Is the president listening? And to develop a few more solar sites. They also hope to include the $2.6 million it's costing them to take this case before the Utilities Commission. They want to include that in the rate hike. How would any potential rate increase, if that's approved, impact customers? How much more will we have to
well,
pay?
What,
you know?
Yeah, what they're asking at least for, because let's remember too, Duke is actually broken up into two segments in North Carolina.
Right.
There's Duke Energy Progress and there's, I guess, Duke Classic, if we will. So here in the Charlotte region, they're asking for a 13.6% rate hike. And my favorite headline, it's not quite a New York Post kind of headline, but it's pretty darn good about this whole thing, is WRAL's, and I quote, Duke Energy rate increase request, $2.6 million worth of complicated.
that is
and,
good headline.
And here's what it is. Like, yes, they are talking about transitioning to natural gas. Yes, they are talking about solar. But also buried in this rate request, they want ratepayers to cover the cost of the bottled water.
I knew that's where you were going.
That
yeah,
Duke, and you can't blame me. And
yeah.
They want ratepayers to cover the cost of the bottled
yeah.
water that Duke Energy is required by law to pay
why,
for those people living near coal ash ponds where the ponds may be leaking.
Why shouldn't stockholders pay for that? It's a company problem. It's not a ratepayer problem.
Well, this is and that's exactly Duke Energy's argument. They say we are a regulated utility. This is a regulatory cost just like anything else. But you do have to ask yourself this. You may be regulated. However, if you have been saying as a company that you are putting out this bottled water not because it is necessary, even before the law and now after the law, you're doing it because it is good just reaching
right.
out to the community, then you don't charge the community for you being good to the community.
Hard to be a good Samaritan when you submit the invoice.
It's going to get the tax write-off.
So when will we hear the state's decision or the regulatory board's decision on this rate hike?
I'm not sure.
I don't know if there's a specific target date yet.
It is $2.6 million a complicated, so I'm guessing it's going to be a little while.
Okay. Vi Lyles was sworn in this week as Charlotte's new mayor, the city's first female African-American mayor.
There's been a lot of attention about this, my being the first black woman mayor of Charlotte. And I'm really proud to have made that history. But this history is not alone what I want to be known for. I want to be known as a mayor who restored faith between our neighborhoods and City Hall.
Does that restoration need to occur? Is that what happened? Was that broken because of the last administration?
For the voters, they might feel that way. I mean, they voted for her significantly. I mean, this was not a close race. Violet Lyles won by several percentage points. And she talked about, during her speech, it was actually pretty short, but she talked about some of the same things she talked about on the campaign trail. So more affordable housing, better jobs, better public safety. But she also pointed out that she didn't want her legacy to be just the first African-American woman mayor, but also spreading opportunity for everyone in the city. And obviously that Opportunity Task Force report is still lingering in people's minds, with Charlotte being 50 out of 50th for upward mobility.
She was on this program Monday morning before she was sworn in, and she said that the anticipated crowd for her swearing in and for that of council was so large that they had to open a set. They were planning to open a second room because the council chamber would not have accommodated all the people who said they wanted to come. Was that in fact the case?
Oh yeah, I mean there was. All reserved seating was all of the chambers, yeah. And the media pit was probably, I mean, it's about the size of the circle, and it fit, it had like 20 people in there. So it was very packed, and I mean, they were streaming it, and they even told people, hey, if you can't make it, don't even try and come, just watch it online at the government channels, because it was so many people. And it was a historic night, especially with Violet Lyles, but then also all the new city council members, and just this new breath coming to city council after 2 years. You have challenges, of crisis, of turbulence. People, I think, are ready for some fresh voices.
What's going to be interesting to watch is, you know, Violet Lyles is and she describes herself as a process person. She's very measured. And yet, I think when you had her and Kenny Smith on before the election, she talked about, you know, it's not time for plans. We've had enough of those. It's time for action. I mean, she's been very aggressive. And so, much like these new council members, and of course, the challenge there is everyone is excited. Everyone wants to see these things happen. And then you get into the grinding gears of government. So can they actually push some of these things forward in a significant enough way that the voters out there recognize progress? That's the real test of the next 2 years.
And it's got to come fast for Violet Lyles. I mean, again, she has built her career first in city government and then as an elected member of city government on planning. And when you campaign on action now, action now, action now, I've said this before, and it's absolutely true. It is incredibly seductive on the campaign trail, but it also means that you have to deliver much faster than other campaign promises. So, you know, I'm very curious to see where we go from here. I think you can start seeing action. I'm not saying that it is impossible. I think it is possible. But in order to get that, it's not as much up to the mayor. It's up to the council.
That's right.
And I saw almost the perfect symbol of that yesterday afternoon. I was on Facebook, and the message came up, Braxton Winston is live. Let's talk city committees. And it was Braxton and Tark Bakari and Larkin Eggleston, three of the young city council members, and they were just sitting there with their phones, and they were talking about the importance of citizens applying for these advisory panels and committees that are out there. And, you know, you think about, we all got to know Braxton Winston through his live streaming, and Braxton Winston Live meant he was probably out there in the midst of a really intense protest with police and riot gear. And in the course of a year or so, he has made this transition to somebody who is trying to talk people into understanding
and
the importance.
I know you want to talk.
It was close to 600 views after a couple of hours.
And I think it's interesting that you have two Democrats and a Republican sitting together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And all of the newer council members, I've talked to most of them, they want to find ways to get millennials involved, not just with running for office, but just doing just that, getting involved with the city committees. Because if you think about it, those are the people who are really, you know, talking with the committee heads, they're talking with city council about what needs to happen. That's where the power is, and they want to find ways to get millennials connected in that way, mm-hmm. and finding a way to bring them into city government. Because let's face it, a zoning meeting is not sexy, it's not exciting. How do you get millennials in? Because what the city council does will affect these 44 people coming in each day, which most of them are millennials.
I think millennials must understand. Don't you think they understand that zoning is important? I mean, just this morning, there's this chart in the Observer about the number of new zoning requests that have come in just this year alone. It's astronomical.
Yeah, but,
and it's
I think people vaguely understand.
I don't. I don't think it's a millennial thing. I think it's across generational lines. I mean,
People coming.
Fine, but you know, you say don't millennials understand that zoning is important? I would argue the vast majority of every population doesn't think of zoning as being important yet.
Until it hits them personally.
Right. And if you think at its core, and I'm glad that we're talking about this, because at its core, zoning is the single form of government that will impact everyone's life almost immediately. It's traffic, it's sewer, it's water, it's where you live, it's where you work.
Property values.
Absolutely. Yes.
In fact, we're going to do 3 hours on zoning starting now. No, I'm kidding. But the one thing that did strike me, other than Vi Lyles and what she said, was going back to Braxton Winston. You know, he got the loudest and most sustained applause when he was introduced at the swearing in the other night. Mm. And just listening to that, and he made some remarks about social justice and what he wants to do on council. And I just thought about the immediate pressure on him. I mean, because he is the best known of the incoming council members, because he already has a reputation as someone who is out in the community fighting for change, it's a lot of pressure to go in and fix the world.
A lot of credit for still being here talking about the importance of city committees, because there are a lot of us of all generations who are there when the adrenaline's pumping and there's some drama on the streets, and then, you know, when it comes time to say, let's talk about city government, it's like, oh, look at the time. I gotta go.
Well said.
Also worth noting, Braxton Winston also had a very – he actually, I think, had the most powerful speech out of all of them, even more powerful than Mayor Lyles. He talked about the lack of – now there are – yes, we all talked about all these new voices. That's so exciting. But he said, with this election, we lost 4 women voices on the dais. And that was very powerful for, again, a man to be talking about the lack of women who are now sitting at the dais, and also – just how women pushed his career and his life. He talked about his wife, his grandmother, aunts, black women who helped him out, and then women who ran his campaign. So that was very interesting for him to point that out as, again, a man in politics.
They might need to set up an exchange with the CMS school board, which as of this coming Tuesday will have 8 women, but nobody under 40. So maybe they can
talk about it. We can keep it.
All right, we must stop. We must stop and ask for money. So so we'll do that. We'll come back and we'll talk about JCSU being on probation and the abortion clinic protest, which was substantial this past weekend. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks of the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ann Doss Helm from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News Charlotte, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. For 2 years, questions have been circling, Ann, around Johnson C. Smith University about money problems, and this week the school was placed on probation by an accrediting agency. What does this mean?
Not a lot immediately. It means that they are going to take a year to dive deeper into their finances and come back in a year and decide. This is every 10 years or so their accreditation comes up for renewal, or they use a different phrase, but basically renewal. And the worst thing they could have done would be to say, your finances are a mess, we revoke your accreditation. That would have been a huge deal. That would have been, you know, you would have then had trouble doing financial aid. There would have been real repercussions for students and faculty. The best thing for Johnson C. Smith they could have done would just be say, hey, everything's fine, you know, see us in another 10 years. And what they did was take that middle path. And we don't have a lot of details about that yet. They will post a report on that late next week. They just had the meeting this week. So all we know is that they cited financial concerns and financial stability.
Documents filed with the IRS showed a $7.5 million deficit for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2014, and a $10 million deficit for the year ending in June 30th, 2013. So that's what, $17.5 million. Why the deficits and why is the IRS involved? Are they not paying their taxes?
I don't know details on it, but I do know that Johnson C. Smith said that they are not at a deficit anymore.
Okay.
So their take on it, and of course, their press release was a masterpiece of, you know, glass half full. You know, they've kept our accreditation going. They had something about that this was just an opportunity to do an even better job and improve our already strong services. So, you know, they're putting the spin on it. But they said this is all about one footnote in their audit.
Such an interesting detail, that one random footnote that they won't talk about yet.
And they say that they have done it the same way for a couple of years, and that this year the auditor insisted on adding one sentence to that footnote. Mm-hmm. And they objected to that. The implication is that it's a trivial thing, or that nothing has changed except the way they're stating it. But the auditor obviously felt strongly enough to say, no, we're not taking this out. And then the accreditation agency obviously felt strongly enough that when they read that sentence, they said, whoa, we need to look at this more closely.
Johnson C. Smith President Ron Carter is going to be replaced by Clay Armbrister on January 1st. Is this why?
Well, Definitely not.
I mean, the money problem.
The money problems were certainly out there, and I don't know, again, the internal politics well enough to know if this is just the point at which Ron Carter would have normally moved on to something else. But certainly, they looked for a candidate and found a candidate who has deep background, not only in education, but in financial matters. He's a former city treasurer. They are looking for him, I am sure, to get them on a stronger financial footing.
Normally, when you hear talk about losing accreditation at a school, what you're talking about is something going wrong with the academic side of things. This is the financial side of things. So why would finances put the school's accrediting, or if that's the right word, into jeopardy?
Well, I think they look at both. There's a long checklist of things that they do for accreditation, and certainly many of them are about academics and about integrity, but it's the overall operations. Accreditation is supposed to be a signal that this nonprofit independent body has given you a good review and says, yes, this, you know, you should
feel
stable
in all areas.
Yeah. So this is, you know, this is, it's not Charlotte School of Law where you have, you know, huge academic and financial things, but it's a concern.
So they're on probation. How long does that last? What do they have to do to get off probation? How serious is this? Is this a case of another school in Charlotte maybe going bye-bye because of financial problems?
You know, I don't have the great depth of knowledge on higher education to say that with great confidence, but it feels like they are not in the level of trouble that Charlotte School of Law was. And they certainly are saying, you know, we've made some changes. We had some problems several years back. They're just sort of rippling through to us now. Basically, what will happen is there will be a campus visit in the fall of 2018, and there will be an in-depth review of whatever this mysterious sentence is that presumably, you know, it's got to be a little more complicated than just checking one box. But there will be this, and then they will come back in December of 2018 and either do the bad thing or say, great, you've got another 10 years.
This doesn't feel anywhere near as severe as the federal government's coming in and saying, we won't provide student aid to your institution. I mean, that's a big gap. I don't know. I agree with you. I don't know the intricacies of Johnson C. Smith, but that's a long way from what was going on with Charlotte School of Law.
Yeah, there's still a trick here, though, or at least a danger here, though, for Johnson C. Smith, which is that accreditation itself. Regardless of whether let's say hypothetically, when they come back, as Ann described, late next year, and the accrediting body decides to pull the accreditation, albeit for financial reasons and not academic ones, well, that calls into question the value of that diploma. So even though this is not, by at least our account so far, a repeat of all the craziness that went on at the Charlotte School of Law, mm-hmm. it could cause significant problems, because why would you pay the amount of money to go to a university if you end up with a degree that means little or less than it did just a year ago?
Well, and the other thing is, with the change in leadership, all colleges, higher education, are under a ton of financial pressure, but particularly historically black colleges and
yes.
universities have had a lot of pressure lately, and they've also struggled with enrollment. So it's already a little bit of a challenge, so you want to obviously get rid of any problems with accreditation or anything like that.
And there is a good side here. I mean, just I believe today I was hearing about it. I think the news came out either yesterday or around this week, that Elizabeth City State University has actually come off of probation because they were able to, you know, stabilize finances, and it looks like enrollment is up. Now, that is itself a separate kind of interesting situation, because they're one of the schools that changed, you know, how much they were going to charge under this whole new, system that was set up by the General Assembly. But it is a bit of good news.
I think the other thing that needs to be mentioned is that Johnson C. Smith, beyond the education that it provides, is such a crucial part mm-hmm. of revitalizing the West Side. And Ron Carter in particular really
yes.
made that a big part of his tenure. So you want Johnson C. Smith to be healthy, because the West Side and its continued growth and building depends on that in a lot of ways.
Not to change topics, but we are. Protests have been going on at a preferred women's health clinic for the better part of a year, maybe longer. We did a whole program on this earlier this year. And last Saturday, though, there was a large anti-abortion march that took place. Here's one of the protesters.
We don't push them to make a decision, because ultimately it is their decision what they do, but we want them to know that there are other options.
But the presence of so many protesters can obviously be intimidating, according to one of the abortion rights supporters who served as an escort to guide patients past the protesters.
The end result is they are here shaming women for a personal health care decision.
People are trying to have some privacy, and dignity is unkind.
So both of the people in that clip sound very reasonable, very low-key, very polite. Has that been the atmosphere at these protests over the course of the year and last Saturday in particular, Kirsten?
At some, and I have not been at all of them, but I know last year they had a massive one that even got the attention of some national media, I think even the Huffington Post. But I know this conversation has been happening all year in terms of safety, not even about the abortion issue, whether you're for it or against it. I know I've talked with some abortion clinic workers there who were saying they've been pushing for no parking signs or more CMPD officers because they just want people to be safe going in and out of the clinic.
Set the scene for this, because most people don't know where this is, and it's on a little horseshoe street that is relatively narrow, and it's kind of like an office park environment, right?
Yeah, it's not really a very wide street, and it has more than – there are other businesses besides this clinic.
Right.
I think everyone just focuses on the clinic on Latrobe Drive, but it's more than that. And that's why the clinic said earlier this year they were pushing for some kind of regulation that would keep everyone safe. They said protesters and clinic workers.
So before we went on the air today, you said that you suggested to your employer – Spectrum News, that they send a reporter out there this weekend. How did you know in advance that this was going to be a bigger than normal protest?
CMPD actually gave me a heads up that they were sending extra officers in that direction for the protest on, I think it was the Monday before. So about obviously a week out, they were
already
preparing
for that. Why was the protest bigger this weekend than it was on previous weekends? Because they're there every day, aren't they?
Correct. Well, every Saturday is their big days.
Right.
But there's some people are there every day. But yeah, Saturdays are always their big day. But it's maybe like 10 to 50 people. This was the Love Life Prayer Walk. So it's one of their big annual events. And I think it was the fourth or fifth one. So this is like it drives thousands literally each year. And I think this one was close to 5,000, if I'm correct.
All of this got the attention of several city council members who were there, including Braxton Winston, Julie Iselt, Luana Mayfield, Justin Harlow, and Larkin Eggleston. Iselt has since said that she'd like to have more conversations about how to best allocate resources, including police officers, near the clinic in the future. This isn't the first time that someone has asked the city to act or take a more prominent role in all of this, is it?
Correct. No, there have been a lot of calls, like I said, starting earlier this year, and they started with the parking issue because they figured that was something that could easily change how people access that street. Because what the clinic is saying is that some of these protesters who are pro-life are taking over the street, and then women who are going to the clinic, they don't know who's with the clinic and who's
right.
not.
They have to run the gauntlet.
Exactly. And that's what they said. That's what it was. And also cars are driving by and potentially hitting protesters.
And not everybody who goes to that clinic is going there for an abortion.
Correct. I mean, it's a health clinic. It's obviously there are no, I mean, you can get an abortion there, and that's what the protesters are there for.
Is this the only clinic of its kind in Charlotte?
I cannot answer that question, but I feel like it's not.
Why this one? Why is this one the one that they target? Is this the biggest one, the most active one? More people come to this one?
I think it is one of the bigger ones, but I know it also is it's been the place, at least all year, of where these two groups meet.
And does anybody know how effective these ongoing protests have been? Have they decreased the number of women who use that clinic either for medical reasons not associated with abortion or for abortions themselves?
I can't speak to that because I'm not obviously at the clinic,
okay.
But I do know they talked about how it is a sense of, as you said, women are literally running a gauntlet just to get to the building themselves, or they're getting confused. They're not sure who is,
right.
you know, supposed to be taking care of them, or because some of the folks with the pro-life campaign, they have these RVs set up that at first glance they look like medical RVs, because when you think about when you give blood, the Red Cross will have a little RV
right.
or something. And that was part of it, is that women who may have had a different legit medical concern are being drawn to these vans where they may not supposed to be.
And you do hear anecdotal stories from the people who are in the pro-life group about someone that they talked to in council, and this person was confused and under pressure and didn't really want an abortion, and then with support was able to, you know, give birth to a child. And I think their feeling is that, you know, you don't need to necessarily budge hundreds or thousands, that if there's even one mother and child, that then they've done something valuable.
Okay. Mecklenburg County property tax revaluations are just around the corner. That's some happy news
Woo-hoo!
To hear. The last one was in 2011. It had to be redone because there were errors involved. Notices will go out about the next revaluation on January 1st, 2019. Is that right? If it's a year away, why are we talking about this now?
Well, because we just got over talking about the last one,
right.
because it was botched so badly,
yes.
I think, is part of the problem. And that's one of the big things.
When they take 5 or 6 years, you got to get on it early. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the reason they're doing it again, which is probably why everybody
they have to do it,
is right. required well, yes. by law. They have to do it at least every 9 years. And I think, you know, one of the big things that people pointed to with the incredibly botched former revaluation is just a lack of communication. So now they're, you know, it's the classic, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them.
And remember, Jennifer Roberts was on the county commission then, caught a lot of heat for initially fighting that reassessment of the revaluation, I guess would be the cleanest way to say that.
And just because your property is revalued does not necessarily mean that your taxes will go up. And there's a whole formula for that, which we don't have time to talk about, nor do we have time to talk about the lead story, which is the fact that it's Wendy Bratz, our executive producer's birthday today.
We'll happy birthday,
happy
Wendy.
Happy birthday. Happy
birthday.
We'll sing the song off the air. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.